You're listening to RNIB Connect Radio. As the coronation of King Charles III approaches, we're taking a look back at royal coronations in history. And who better to speak to than an expert royal historian? We're joined now by author and historian Lucinda Gosling. Lucinda, thanks for speaking to us today.
Pleasure. Hello.
For most people watching on May the 6th, this will be their first coronation. What can they expect?
Well, they can expect something quite magnificent. It may not be quite as magnificent as the coronation that took place for the King's mother in 1953. There's been a lot of publicity from the palace itself to say that this will be a more pared-down coronation. But I think that despite that, I think what we'll be seeing is history in action. We'll be seeing a lot of pageantry, some wonderful costumes. Obviously, the crown jewels will be out and in action, rather than sitting behind glass in the Tower of London. It will be a shorter ceremony than past coronations. But as you said, there's very few people now who will remember 1953 coronations. So I think to compare would be silly, really. I think we can expect something quite spectacular and very interesting to witness.
And how has that ceremony changed across history? Would it be recognisable to monarchs from hundreds of years ago?
It would, actually, and I think that is what is very significant about the coronation, is it is probably the closest we would get to medieval ceremonial ritual. And there are lots of key elements of coronations which, you know, go back to the Middle Ages, which they might recognise in a present-day coronation. They will be at the very core of that, so it will be elements like the anointing of the king, which is the most sacred moment where oil or chrism will be applied by the archbishop to the king's head and to his chest. And that, you know, that ritual goes back to even the times of the Old Testament. Obviously, the actual moment of crowning, that again, we know that even kings, English kings, before William the Conqueror were often given a circlet or possibly a helmet to wear, not a crown. The first crown that we can see, which is recognisable, is probably on the Bayeux Tapestry worn by King Harold. So there will be that. And then there's the enthronement. So he will sit in King Edward's chair to be crowned, and then he will move onto a sort of raised platform, which I guess is raising him symbolically above the people. And that, again, is centuries old, the Vikings. Not that they had thrones necessarily, but this action of sitting higher, being placed higher than your subjects, goes back a long, long way.
And even with the precision planning involved in coronations, things can't always go as expected, can they? Are there any moments from coronations that particularly stick out as unusual?
Well, yes. I've written about this a few times, actually. There have been a few mishaps over the years. I'm sure that the king is probably well aware of these and hopes to avoid them. Obviously, 1953, Queen Elizabeth II's coronation ran like a well-oiled machine, and she was faultless in her performance. But prior to that, lots of things went wrong. Queen Victoria, famously, apparently, when the coronation ring, also known as the wedding ring of England, was put on her finger, the Archbishop forced it on with some sort of brutality. She had to stifle a cry of pain, and apparently afterwards she had to soak her hand in cold water to try and get it off. And then Edward VII's coronation, the Archbishop there was quite elderly, quite infirm, and quite doddery on his feet. And he, when he went to pay homage to the king afterwards, which is another sort of ancient tradition where high members of the clergy and dukes will come and pay homage to the monarch afterwards. But the Archbishop was unable to get up from his feet, and the king had to sort of extend his hand and help him to get up. And then I think, it was the coronation of George VI. The Archbishop put his finger over a key part of the text during the coronation oath. So all these things are disastrous, you know, but probably in the great scheme of things aren't terrible. And probably the worst thing that happened was at George IV's coronation, which was the most extravagant ever known. It cost £245,000back at the beginning of the 19th century. And there were thousands of candles, which, and this took place in July, so it was very hot. There were ladies in the abbey fainting left, right and centre, apparently. There were thousands of candles. They were all dripping hot wax onto the congregation below, who, of course, were all in their finery. And then on top of all that, the king's estranged wife, Caroline of Brunswick, demanded entry to the abbey. And the king had installed prize fighters as sort of doormen. And they would not let her in. They said, no ticket, no admission. And eventually she had to give up and go home. But it was probably quite an embarrassing scenario, I'd imagine.
So a few points there that hopefully King Charles would be able to avoid.
Let's hope so, yeah.
A lot of your work, Lucinda, has focused on the images and iconography of history. Are there common themes that link coronations throughout history? And have we seen any of those in the build-up so far to the king's coronation?
Well, I think there's things like colours. You know, I mean, when the monarch arrives at the abbey, they are dressed in red velvet, and ermine and miniver. And then when they leave, they're wearing a purple robe. And that's, you know, that's echoed, isn't it? When you see lots of, even down to publications that are coming out, purple is that sort of classic regal colour, which very much sums up the coronation. I think that, you know, the crowns, it would be interesting to see whether there are many street decorations. That's always been quite an interesting aspect of the coronation. For the Queen's coronation, Sir Hugh Casson was engaged to be in charge of those. And what he did was around London is he would choose a different street. I think on Oxford Street, for instance, you would have shoes and hats to reflect the trades of that street. And on Whitehall, the decorations were in the forms of helmets and breastplates to reflect the household cavalry who were kept there. I mean, things like uniforms change over the centuries, but I think there is a lot of, you know, basic symbolism about, you know, those key elements of the coronation, whether that's the regalia or the colours or the people who are participants, particularly sort of the military side of things. So I think we'll see a lot of that.
And do you think that a coronation is more than just one day? Do you think that it helps to set the tone for the reign of a monarch? Have we seen that in history?
We have absolutely seen it with Queen Elizabeth II. 1953, everyone's the coronation. And because it was such a mass occasion, this was the first time it was televised. So, and eventually it was, you know, people could watch it around the world on television. The coronation of her father, George VI, was filmed, but it wasn't televised. It wasn't, you know, transmitted in the same way. So I think that, you know, there really was a kind of mass celebration and participation, even if you weren't there in the abbey. Whereas if you go back to, sort of, you know, Queen Victoria, unless you're there or you're in London, you can't witness it. Having said that, all around the country, you would have people celebrating. I mean, a really kind of typical thing in the late 18th and through the 19th century were towns and cities creating wonderful kind of decorated ceremonial arches and decorating public buildings. And as we, you know, as the growth of the department store happens in the late 19th century, early 20th century, places like Selfridges and Harrods would sort of swathe themselves in swags and flags and bunting and you know, statuary. So I think that, you know, those 20th century coronations are much more memorable because of mass media. And what we have to rely on when you're going back in time are, you know, for instance, the coronation of Charles II, both John Evelyn and Samuel Pepys wrote about it. Pepys was there. He was up very high in the abbey. He couldn't see anything. And then he had to leave before the king was actually crowned because he needed to go to the toilet because he'd been there for hours. and then if you go back even further into sort of, you know, the Normans, William the Conqueror and things like that, you know, you're really relying on chroniclers and what they're saying about it and on contemporary artists. And that's, you know, the problems of that and how, you know, certain monarchs are represented in art and in, you know, other media like that. So we cannot be absolutely certain that we're getting a true picture. Whereas when we're looking at 20th century coronations, we are seeing photographs. We can see what it looks like. The very first photographs of a coronation were Edward VII's, and Sir Benjamin Stone, very important photographer, he was allowed in and took a few photographs of the interior and what was happening.
And you've written a lot in your work about the history of the royal family during the last few hundred years. What is it that keeps people coming back and wanting to learn more?
I think what's interesting in the present period is there are a lot of people who aren't interested, and there is a lot of debate online and elsewhere about the relevance of the monarchy and whether we even need one anymore. But I think what is so interesting about the coronation is what we started talking about, is that thread of continuity and the fact that you can see these aspects of medieval kingship, you know, following all the way through into the 21st century. And I think that's really, really fascinating. There aren't many things that are mystical and interesting and kind of spectacular in the same way that a coronation is. And whether you're actually a royalist or not, I think to witness that and see a coronation actually happening is to, you know, as I said before, it's to witness history, isn't it? And I think that's what's so interesting. And there's lots of details, you know, some people that are interested in all the, you know, the regalia and the crowns and that sort of aspect of it. Some people will be tuning in. They just want to see what people are wearing. I mean, I'm going to be writing about what the king wears on the day, which I'm going to be quite intrigued about, because I don't think he's going, I hope to goodness he's not going to be in, you know, brocade breeches and silk stockings. I'm sure he won't be. but that's what his predecessors wore. I mean, George IV was in the most ridiculously flamboyant costume of silver and gold with rosettes and all sorts of things. He was in his late 50s and quite portly by the time he was crowned. So, I mean, I would imagine that the king is probably going to wear uniform and then will have his robes over that, but it'll be interesting to see. And I think that's the other thing about the coronation. Yes, you've got this sort of this artery of history running through it, but it has to also move with the times. And that's particularly what the king and the palace are very keen to do with this. You know, they're not inviting as many people. Well, I don't think it will be so heavy with, you know, the peerage. And that has been the case in the past. I think they were bringing in different parts of society and just really trying to make it inclusive. So I'm, for one, quite interested to see what happens today and to be able to compare it to what happened over the centuries.
And where do you plan on watching the coronation on May the 6th? Are you hoping to be there in person, or will you be watching on television?
No, well, no, I'm not. I think if I could be guaranteed a front row seat, but I'm not prepared to camp out on the pavements. There's so much stuff, you know. I mean, I work at Mary Evans Picture Library. We're a historical archive, and so a lot of the stuff that I write about is inspired by the archive. And a lot of coronation history I can find in the archive. And there are so many accounts by people talking about, basically, you can't, you know, they went to see the coronation, which they would have had to pre-Elizabeth II. If you wanted to see it, you had to go there in person. And, you know, so many of them couldn't see anything. So I have a feeling that might be the case. I'll be watching it at home, mainly because I've got a tight deadline to write this piece about what he's wearing. I've got to file that the next day.
And we mentioned your writing, your book, Royal Coronations. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
I actually wrote it a decade ago now, and its time has finally come. But what it is, it's a Shire book. And if any of your listeners are familiar with those, they are small, concise histories on certain subjects. They cover a very, very broad spectrum of different subjects, everything from seaside peers to, I did another one for them on debutantes in the London season. So Royal Coronations, if you want a nice, really sort of concise potted history of coronations, that's what it is. There are other books out, but they are quite hefty tomes, and mine kind of takes all the important bits and puts it in there. And it's also, you know, very heavily illustrated with images from Mary Evans as well.
Lovely. And where's the best place to find that?
I think you can find it on Amazon. It's also available in quite a lot of sort of, you know, heritage bookshops. You probably get it in, you know, the Westminster Abbey shop, that those sort of places.
Fantastic. Well, we'll look forward to the big day on May the 6th. Author and historian Lucinda Gosling, thanks for joining us here on RNIB Connect Radio.
Thanks very much.